It's time to kick back and grab a beer, because the space cadets are here. Talking about space and the universe, let's all be giant science nerds. We're the space cadets, yeah, we're the space cadets.
Guys, episode 3 of the Space Cadets podcast, and I'm a little more disappointed starting this one out than I was on episode 2. The Yankees got eliminated from the World Series by Houston, which sucks, obviously. But I don't know if you guys have been watching the game tonight, game 2 of the World Series. Houston and Washington are going back and forth on Twitter because there's a space station in Maryland called the Goddard Space Station. And there's also, obviously, a space station in Houston. And they are having a Twitter feud right now over who's going to win this World Series. So I thought that was awesome. But I know you guys are all diehard Yankee fans, so I wanted to take a moment of solace here as a New Yorker and just say, we'll get them next time, Yankees. Welcome to episode 3 of the podcast. We have a crew returning from last episode, as well as one new addition that we want to introduce. So, Mr. Sean, why don't we toss it over to you and get a little intro. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing well and super excited to talk about the Major League Baseball playoffs, Todd. Thanks for having me.
I'm sure you are.
Just kidding. I'm happy to be here. I think in terms of space knowledge, it's okay, but if I could equate myself to ski slope colors, I would be green on the bunny slopes, not exactly blue, hoping to get to red at one point.
Very good. Well, welcome to the show, Sean. We're happy to have you. Today on the episode, what we wanted to talk about is the commercialization of space and how business is evolving and how we're moving into, away from just terrestrial business and into commercializing the unknown and the universe. And this led me to start thinking about other big revolutions we've had in the world. And it's impossible not to go back in history and think of things like, the invention of fire, discovery of fire and the wheel, and then moving on, later after weapons and the Bronze Age and the, all the other metalworking components that led to developments in history, all the way to things like the steam engine and assembly lines and mass production. And more recently, things like telecommunications and then the internet and social media. And today, what I would consider being the most prevalent development is artificial intelligence. And now we're trying to continue that progress by seeing how can we make big business or commercialization of space a thing? How can we start using the cosmos to be our tool to help propel us further into the future? With that, I thought I'd throw a little fun fact that I thought was really interesting, but in you think about it, not such a fun fact. So if you guys had to guess, how many pieces of garbage would you think are there in the oceans of the world?
Unfortunately, billions, billions and billions of pieces of garbage.
100 billion.
Yeah, so there's a ton. There's actually 5.25 trillion pieces of garbage weighing about 269,000 tons that are in our oceans. That's a pretty incredible amount. And you think about, going back to those different ages of the world and discoveries and things that we've done as a civilization and littering, right? And the process that's led to the oceans having this much trash in them probably only started, I don't know, what would you think, like 200 years ago, if in any serious capacity. And what I think is amazing is that if you look up into space today, right, where we've only been for just over 60 years, there's already 200,000 pieces of space debris. That's an incredible number. It's nowhere near the 5.25 trillion pieces, but it just goes to show you how we're following in those same unfortunate footsteps and littering our cosmos, especially our low Earth orbit, with all of these pieces of debris and these things that eventually could be damaging to our other pursuits. Anyway, I thought we'd start this episode after that real ominous note and tone about things that we've, as a civilization, done negatively with something fun. If you were a supervillain, who would you be, and what would your supervillainy task be?
If I were a space villain, Todd, I would have to say, I haven't thought of my name yet. I'll get back to you on that. But what I would do is actually relating to what you just said, with all the space garbage and the shrapnel. If you could send something up to space that exploded into many different pieces, you could take out a lot of the functions that humans rely on every day.
Alex, you stole my answer, and I have the name for your supervillain. The name of your supervillain would be Kessler, because what you just talked about is something called the Kessler syndrome. And I think it was the movie Gravity that showed this right in the beginning, where one small chain reaction led to a whirlwind of small debris flying around and taking out every communication satellite. And so, wow, man, that was we didn't plan that. And nice. That was the exact answer that I was going to give. Very cool.
Nice. Sandra Bullock level answer. You little genius.
Well, cool. So anybody else have any? Nathan, I'm sure you got some crazy answer for this one.
I mean, we want to basically gobble up the garbage with a giant mouth or orifice, pulling it all in, getting it out of the way so we can fire up more of it up there.
So that would be your supervillain task. You'd be a galactic garbage man.
Well, I thought we were still talking about clearing the debris, but now that you mentioned it, yes, I think that'd be a good function for me.
Wouldn't that be a great idea for a pursuit if we were going to create a company that was going to start making some money in space? Is if we had the funds and the means to do it, become the garbage men of space.
It is something that I think is currently being tested, but I believe there is someone who is creating a device that's basically designed to catch trash in space.
I wonder where they would bring it. Or would they, like, what makes more sense to me is you bump into it and knock it out into the solar system and it just keeps going forever, right? But I guess that,
you know, back to Earth.
And burns up. Yeah, so you just got to drag it down a little bit, like one of those stuffed animal fetching games in the carnivals. Take a little claw hand and pull it in.
Slow its orbit enough that it falls out.
How did all this stuff get up there in the first place? I thought it'd be helpful to talk a little bit about the start of commercial use of space. And in some of my research, you know, we'll keep this part brief, but we found that, you know, the first commercial use of outer space was back in the 60s. And it was actually used, called the Telstar 1 satellite. And that was used to transmit TV over the Atlantic between the US and Europe. And it was actually funded by AT&T and a company called Bell Labs. I'm sure you guys have all heard of both of those. And in 64, they launched, the Hughes Aircraft Company launched another satellite, which was sent into orbit. The difference between this one is that it used something called a geosynchronous orbit rather than just a planetary orbit. Do you guys know what geosynchronous means?
Geosynchronous orbit is when something is in orbit at such a level that the orbit aligns with the rotation of the Earth. So it essentially stays directly in place above the planet.
What's cool about this, and it's, you know, one of the interesting first use cases for these satellites, is TV satellites, you think DirecTV, you think all these services that utilize satellites to send signals, they have certain coverage areas, right? And so geosynchronous satellites are really important for that component of it. And so this satellite in 1964 was actually used to broadcast the Olympics from Tokyo to the US, which had never been done before. So that was pretty impressive back in the day. And it was all because of these satellites. You know, since then we've had developments as it pertains to weather satellites and GPS. And I just think it's really interesting that it all started, you know, from these communication satellites and pivoted their way to TV. And now there are thousands and thousands of satellites up there floating around. The reason that we're seeing so many more satellites launching today is due to the exponential decrease in costs of launching satellites up into space. So it cost an incredible amount of money back in the 50s when we're talking about the Vanguard engine rockets taking these satellites up to space. We're talking millions of dollars per launch, and it was done at a per kilogram dollar amount. And now, you know, you see people like Elon Musk with the Falcon 9 and Falcon Heavy rockets, which are, you know, reusable, the ability to re-land those, cutting down on those costs so much that putting satellites into space is becoming something so much more commercially viable that I'm anticipating we see a huge boom in a space economy. What do you guys think in terms of which businesses would maybe be like the next frontier in space? I've been doing some research. I have some ideas, but be curious to think, like, things we haven't seen yet that are still here on Earth that could potentially benefit from outer space. Sean, our newest guest, any ideas, anything that you've been thinking about?
I think it does have the capability, and this might not be a great thing for Earth, but in terms of like the U.S. Army and, you know, they already use satellites to pinpoint where soldiers are and have communications like halfway across the world, but it's not an instantaneous thing yet. But if more satellites are getting up there and that becomes easier and transmits easier and quicker, then the amount of I don't know, money that can be made off of that is, I feel like, substantial.
Yeah, I mean, you think about all of this increase in things being produced, moved to space, things being brought into space, infrastructure, like gas stations. The increases in space travel with increases in the desire to be multiplanetary and, you know, have a jumping off point to go from Earth to possibly to the moon, then to Mars, wherever it might be.
Sean, your neighbor up there in Seattle actually had the same idea as Mark, believe it or not, with Blue Origin. So Jeff Bezos and the company Blue Origin actually wants to land through what's called the Artemis Project back on the moon in 2024. And part of that is launching a rocket up to from the Kennedy Space Center, rather, and linking up with something that NASA's planning to build called the Gateway Station, which is essentially a gas station in space. And it's going to be a place where the actual lunar module that's going to wind up landing on the moon is going to be ready to receive the payload from Earth and then take that over to the moon. So, you know, you and Bezos have a lot in common, Mark. Also, similar build post his getting ripped up and jacked and wearing that military-style vest around.
Yeah, and net worth, I would say, is close.
Yeah, probably just about on par. Do you know, I actually didn't know this, which I'm kind of embarrassed about, but apparently, according to Mr. Bezos in one of his talks, he mentioned that they've already found water on the moon, or that at least they
well, there's
think.
A substantial amount of ice on the moon.
Right.
That can't evaporate if we're counting that as water, but I don't know.
No, yeah. Sean, that's exactly it. It's stuck in these craters, right, as ice, and the sun never hits it, and it's just there and frozen. And what Bezos is saying he wants to do is land there and use that as a refueling station to continue the gas station talk track here a little bit, to break down that water into hydrogen and oxygen and then build rocket fuel from the moon and then use that to explore the universe. Yeah.
To take the byproducts of creating rocket fuel from ice and possibly crafting Slim Jims and or Red Bull.
Well, those already give you wings, so hypothetically you could just, you know, snap into a Slim Jim
in space.
Well, yeah, I guess not. As long as you have enough motion, maybe the all right, here you go. Eat enough of those Slim Jims, you'll have enough thrust coming out of one end of you that your wings can just you know, guide you in one direction. You'll be good to go. Have you guys ever seen the movie Elysium with Matt Damon?
Is that the one where it's everything is like replicas of the different sectors?
Yeah. Well, so it is. But the point I was going to make there is they live in that like floating ring that floats, you know, just above Earth, right? But it's paradise, and the people that can't afford it live down on Earth, and it's a slum. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I remember seeing that one.
Different movie, but yeah.
So,
Will's seen every bad movie.
Hey, Will
every,
and I.
Every bad space movie.
Will and I will always have Waterworld. Kevin Costner from back in college. But he wants to build one of these things that floats above Earth. They're called O'Neill colonies, which is named after the guy who created the concept of it. But if you watch videos of Bezos talking about this, he's serious. He wants to create, you know, he's talking about replicating cities on Earth. The weather's always perfect. Rethinking architecture, because why do you need that much cover if it's always beautiful out and perfect? I don't know if I'd want to go live in one of those places. Maybe if the Earth was a slum, would you guys like give it all up and move up to one of these societies up there?
I don't know, but I think the interesting aspect of that application, right, of that society in outer space is actually how they would get there, which is a real life thing that we're in process of developing, or people, or organizations and countries are looking at, which is the space elevator, right? And countries like China and Japan have already declared that they're planning on building one and putting it out there by 2040, 2045, or something like that, which kind of promotes the conversation or the use case of the commercialization of space to another level.
Well, what is a space elevator? I haven't actually researched that.
So it's a tether that's attached to the Earth that extends to a point of something that's in outer space. And whatever the something is that's in outer space is a fueling station or a space center or something people can travel to, right? Tourists or businesses, and create life outside of the planet.
You would take, you would literally be an elevator that
it would be an elevator, essentially. Yeah. And the limitation right now is we don't have the metal, or I guess we haven't developed the metal that can be light enough and strong enough to support a space elevator.
Carbon nanotubes.
Yeah, so there's this whole new, this new technology called that Mark just mentioned, carbon something or other. It's a new metal that they haven't developed to be long enough. They can't create it to be long enough in a single strand for the use case, and it's like 400 times stronger than steel or something like that, and a lot lighter.
In my mind, that thing, because it's that close, like obviously you need horizontal thrust to keep it on pace with the rotation of the Earth, but you'd also probably need vertical thrust in order to keep it from falling. Or are you saying that the tensile strength of that steel is so strong that it just literally stands there?
So I don't know, but I read that basically you'd need to create it around the equator so that the rotation isn't as extreme.
So if you were to put it in space and you have it at the equator where the Earth is rotating, you have that centrifugal force. The actual force that would be on the cable would be in holding it down and anchoring it to the Earth, so it doesn't go flying off into space.
But the really cool thing about a space elevator, and the reason that they propose it, is because it would cut costs so dramatically. Like so much of the money we spend now is to get these things into space. So if you can just take an elevator and get into outer space and then just leave from the terminus of it, it'd save tons of money and create new opportunities.
Yeah, and the cost of actually building it isn't even all that extreme. It's only, you know, $10 billion or $20 billion or something is what I read to actually create the elevator itself. But it's more about the physics and getting around some of the design flaws or concerns like space trash that are prohibiting us from doing it today.
How do you get the tether between space and Earth? Do you drop it from space to Earth, or do you throw it from Earth into space?
You know, that's a great question. I'd imagine there's less of a throw and more of a kind of a rocket takeoff, dragging a cable behind or something.
I would think it would be the drop method, because I feel like you could control a drop.
Look, this has been around for thousands of years, because in the Andes Mountains, there's rope bridges that span between two points that are farther than you can reach by even throwing something. So how did they get those rope bridges across the crevasses? This is the same question we have to answer now as we're building the space elevator.
I feel like space elevator is kind of bland.
Yeah.
Whoever comes up with the best name by the end of this episode gets the space award today.
Oh, nice.
Well, I've heard some really interesting things about some of the satellites that are in space. And then I want to pivot a little bit into talking about something that SpaceX is working on, because I find this extremely interesting, especially since it impacts us every single day. So I heard today that there's some satellites that are orbiting the Earth that have the ability to take a picture where each pixel in that picture is 12 inches, meaning that from space you could see things very clearly, like street lines, or the other example is you'd be able to clearly see somebody standing in New York City from Toronto. We use that technology every day, and we're using Google Maps or Apple Maps to get our satellite view of things. All of those commercial-based companies, they're all utilizing that as part of this. And so, you know, as more of these satellites are up there doing those things, you know, that's one facet of it. But one of the things that I think is going to really revolutionize space and communications, and Will, I'm going to lean on you a little bit because you're the guy who works in the communications field, is what's called Starlink. And it's something that SpaceX is putting into fruition. So they're hoping to have it operational by 2020. But essentially what it is, it's a network of about 12,000 satellites. And the best way to visualize it is to think about a chain link fence and all those little squares and the intersection points. And so the satellites are at all corners of the squares in the chain link fence. And they're in constant communication with one another in sort of a net that floats in low Earth orbit around the globe. And what makes this so advantageous is this net of communications kind of acts like a mesh Wi-Fi network, where as one signal is lost because the location is moving, it automatically transfers it to another. And they do this not using wires, obviously, or not using fiber optics, but using lasers to communicate. And so literally it's like these little satellites playing laser tag with one another, transferring signals back and forth and back and forth to eventually blanket the globe in a perpetual signal of whether that's internet or communications or GPS or any of these other features. Elon Musk obviously is a genius and has tons of things that he's brought to market, whether it's the Tesla or, you know, Solar City, and obviously the making commercial spaceflight a bit cheaper with reusable rocket engines. But I think that this is really going to revolutionize the world. I have some other ideas on that, but I'd love to toss it to you guys to get your comment and feedback and hear what you think about this kind of endeavor.
Pretty wild to think about. You know, it's the whole conversation of IoT, Internet of Things, and combining that with, you know, artificial intelligence and machine learning and 5G networks, and it's really taking it to another level. It's way beyond, you know, I guess it's really not that far beyond where we are today. It's just taking the infrastructure to another level and kind of expanding on the technology that we already have access to. So, it's wild to think about the potential of what it could do for us and what it could create for the future.
Doesn't it feel like these billionaires who are making these things are just like just playing with their money? You know, like what could be the potential financial impact for them that would drive them to do this? And I asked myself that question, but then I looked into it a little bit more and it started to make a lot more sense. So do you know about the transatlantic cable? Are you familiar with that?
Are you talking about the circuit that connects Nova Scotia or somewhere on the East Coast to London for internet and internet connectivity?
Yes.
And it lies on the bottom of the ocean, and it's like, you know, tens of thousands of gigabytes of speed.
Yep, and that's exactly what I'm talking about, Will. And it drives the connection between the stock exchanges, both in London and in, you know, the other continents of the world and the United States, and it connects them. And it's the reason why it was used historically is obviously we didn't have internet back in the day, but now that we have internet, that direct line, which to me, it seems amazing that there's a cable running across the ocean, is what is connecting the stock markets globally and making those microtransactions happen at you know, crazy, crazy speeds, much faster than could happen through Wi-Fi. But the reason that I'm bringing that up is the eventual goal of Starlink and the way that it's going to be funded is the speeds he's promising will beat out that cable by a couple of milliseconds. In terms of latency. And so he's going to sell access to the Starlink program to these large trading firms, these large hedge funds that want to get an edge on the market.
Quite a claim.
That's what he's from the satellites that are up there. Actually, Elon just this week sent his first tweet via those satellites. So it's up and running. But yeah, I think that's amazing. It's an example of something you wouldn't immediately think of, but is incredible.
I don't think that I put a bet down now that I don't think sending a signal off world, looping it around in space and then bringing it back to the planet is ever going to be faster than a fiber optic cable on the planet from one point to another. You know, I put a bet down on that.
Yeah, I'm with Nathan there. I mean, I kind of work in this industry, and so I know firsthand, you know, some of the dark fiber circuits that are out there today and some of the new ones that are dropped, like between the New York and Chicago exchanges, are under 15 milliseconds. You know, it's like a 1,000-mile round trip for packets to travel, and that's shockingly low. And for Elon to make that claim is... it's pretty surprising.
Yeah, I'm with Elon on this one.
We got a debate.
You're shooting light through space. You're shooting light through the vacuum of space, and it wouldn't be faster from New York to Chicago. But if you start talking about around the world, it would be impossible for it to be slower practically.
The speeds grow exponentially with the distance because exactly what Mark just said, the light
year. New York to Tokyo, yep. You're beaming a signal from Earth to space, you know, which would probably be, you know, some node on Earth with a satellite relay point above it, whatever it might be. There would be the time that it would take to go from, you know, the node on Earth through the atmosphere to that first point, and that length through the atmosphere, I would imagine, would be the slowest part just because it would have atmosphere and weather to cut through. But I mean, once you reach that point where you're in space, there's now nothing blocking it. You you have the full speed of light, you know, to travel from one side of the planet to the other and then just shoot back down. You would have that other bottleneck.
In the fiber optic cable the whole way?
I don't believe fiber optic cable is considered unobstructed.
It's not, because it's not considered a vacuum, because it's still passing through a material.
It's a medium, yeah. But yeah,
but I think you don't bet against Elon, that's the thing. When he makes a kind of guarantee, he's usually pretty good with that stuff. As it comes to whether it's, you know, SpaceX or Tesla or anything he does. So he like has this, he's like a Jobs, like anyone else, like these almost like a mad scientist, but like driven by work and makes all his like people work too. And they always get there. Maybe not when they say they will, but I wouldn't think that's completely outlandish. I think it just seems impossible right now, but who knows?
So Mark might be right, because it's saying online that the speed of light is 30% slower, or light travels 30% slower through fiber optics than through a pure vacuum. So if there's a route to faster communications off planet, then maybe it's exploiting that differential. But I'm with Will, just a little hard to imagine. So it'll be quite impressive if they're able to pull it off.
Well, absolutely. And you think about the implications of that to some of Elon's other endeavors, right? Tesla's ultimate goal is to have self-driving cars. And, you know, as good as the sensors are in those vehicles, you guys should definitely go on YouTube and search for the people trying out the new summon feature that just got released for the Tesla. It's it's actually like scary how it works well, but like drives over lines and parking lots and doesn't stop exactly when it should stop. And, you know, it's not there yet, right? And that's the reason why we don't have self-driving cars, you know, just driving around like in Minority Report. But with something like this, where there's millisecond communication that's faster than anything, and it's omnipresent everywhere, and all these satellites can beam down signals all over the place, you know, whether it's Tesla moving to full self-driving cars, or at least highway self-driving cars, Uber investing tons of money in developing a self-driving Uber car, you can start to see where the vision of where companies like Tesla or SpaceX are going. And that's, how do we start building this infrastructure on the backs of our world's dependencies, in this case being the stock market, to fund these projects that will ultimately change civilization? And it's all due to how they're commercializing space, which I think is absolutely incredible. But
That goes back to your first question, Todd. I don't really think, I mean, yes, the flamethrower is frivolous and fun, but I think ultimately if we're calling ourselves space nerds, those two are the biggest space nerds there is. And they're doing it thinking that it's going to help humanity, not just what they're doing in space, but, you know, whether, you know, Tesla or Solar City, that it's for, you know, mankind. And, you know, you could say it's making life better or sustaining life longer on Earth while you try to figure something out in space.
And Sean, you're one of the more philanthropic people that I know. And the last thing I wanted to bring up about this will also provide free high-speed internet globally, all on the backs of capitalism with the stock market. So, on the surface,
globally? It doesn't.
Yeah, because this network will.
Is incredible. I think everyone, we're all in a, being in the United States, or just like, we're all privileged to have the infrastructure that's in place, where there's so many people across the entire globe that have nothing even close to that. And if you're able to have connectivity, then you're able to help people. You're able to maybe get, you know, supplies, medicine. It just, you know, that's like, you know, Gates Foundation. That's something like they want to help with. It's just that they're, so much could be done with that.
Do you know that the Gates Foundation today utilizes satellites to investigate how many different homes are in these rural villages all over the world in underserved and impoverished areas, and use that information to figure out how many health kits to bring when they go and help people? I read about that today. I thought that was amazing.
That's incredible. Yeah.
So I have a question about 5G. We hear about that so much and how that's going to revolutionize the world and connect everyone. Is this something, Starlink, that would be in direct competition with that, or are these two separate things?
Kind of the same in concept, right? But the technology has different limitations, right? It sounds like Starlink has none, apparently. 5G is distance, and the cost of investment and the rate of return. So for them to build out 5G towers everywhere, basically they have to have a ton of, because there's different bands of 5G that stretch over different distances, and to have a full coverage, you have to put satellites all over the place, and the cost of doing that is really expensive. So it's basically the same thing, right? Connecting all the different machines over a network that spans large areas, but just different technology, it sounds like.
So, but if you were in a populated area, let's say a city, New York City, and they had a lot of 5G towers, that could conceivably work just as well as the Starlink that we're talking about.
I mean, conceivably, you know, I think actually there's 5G is pretty available in a lot of areas, and it's becoming more and more available. It's just the technology that we use, like our cell phones, are not 5G enabled. You know, like Apple just releasing this new iPhone that's not 5G enabled was a bit of a surprise to a lot of people, because that's kind of the new wave, the new thing that's coming. And for some organizations already are like Sprint has a pretty well-developed 5G network.
Right. Okay. Just in terms of our space topic, it seems interesting that we'd be going through all this, that Elon Musk would be going through all this for something that could be done here on Earth instead. So there must be other benefits. I know you guys touched on some of them as well.
Speed over distance.
I think it plays into his ultimate vision, which is, you know, colonization of Mars and you know, the first tourism route, right? Space tourism, which is going to be another huge component of it. And, you know, honestly, probably some of it is wanting to be the next big thing. I'm sure there are speed advantages and technological advantages to the way that he's operating the Starlink program. But how else do you prove that you are capable of handling these large NASA contracts or getting the permission to do some of the things that he's doing unless you start there, right? You start up in the skies and put this kind of technology forward. So, you know, in my mind, if he was to just build these great satellites, dishes here in on Earth or all over the country and things like that, it wouldn't be as impressive or as forward looking, you know, as impactful as launching the satellite network. But going back to one thing that I just mentioned a second ago, which is space tourism. Tourism is obviously an industry that's going to grow in the next couple of years, and we know all three major companies, whether it's Virgin Galactic or Blue Origin or SpaceX, are all working on their own versions of it. Alex, it sounds like you've been doing some research about what Mr. Branson's been doing, Sir Branson, I should say.
Right. So he's had the idea for Virgin Galactic for, you know, more than 10 years now. In fact, originally they were supposed to start flights in 2009. Clearly that never happened. Yeah, there's been a lot of big investors in the in Virgin Galactic, which would take tourists to space for some suborbital flights, not quite orbital yet, but maybe about a 90-minute flight with a few minutes of weightlessness. Big investors, including Dublin, Dubai, Virgin Group, State of New Mexico, all putting in millions of dollars to try to get this off the ground. The first passenger did fly in February of 2019.
Really? I didn't know that.
Right. Not a paid passenger, but a test passenger.
Isn't a ticket like $250,000 to get a seat on that?
It is $250,000 deposit.
Ooh, baby. Got to really want to go to space for an hour and a half.
Yeah.
Did you guys, little tidbit, did you know that when Elon started SpaceX that he wanted to become the Southwest Airlines of space?
No status, only peanuts, it smells, and it only goes to Disney World.
There was a space tourist already who did pay to go to space. He actually, I believe, went up with the Russian cosmonauts, and I think he paid something like either $10 or $100 million to do it. This was like back, I'm going to say, late 90s, early
1000s. 1984 was the first space tourist.
Just an update on the two battling space stations. Washington just took an 8-2 commanding lead.
Ooh, that's good because I got my bets in on a sweep. I didn't pick a team. I just bet on a sweep happening.
That wow, I don't think anyone thought it would be this type, but
did yeah. you do that with your wormhole to Jersey, Todd?
I did. I did. Going back to episode one, I love it. Yeah, I wormholed to Jersey. I placed a couple of bets this weekend, one of which was a sweep. Yeah, and then I white-holed myself back to New York.
Love it.
You're lucky that I listened to episode one, so I got that inside joke, but please refrain from doing that in episodes in the future. I want to feel that.
Watch every episode. Read every text.
Do you know what I think the most lucrative space business is going to be? Well, there's two, really. The most lucrative space business is what our good boys in Armageddon were doing, which is space drilling and mining. Mm. Yeah. I've heard major scientists say that the first trillionaire will be the person who owns the an asteroid mining company, the first asteroid mining company, which makes a lot of sense as minerals you can't get on Earth. But I think even more so than that is space insurance companies, which exist today. And as we keep sending more and more businesses and commercial opportunities up into space, the need for that insurance is going to keep going up and up. And today, on average, and this isn't anything to do with manned flights or unmanned flights. This is just the nature. And the majority of our space program today is sending these satellites up, is we lose 1 in 20 rockets for commercial satellite launches. And what's crazy about that, I can't even imagine, I couldn't find any information on this, what the premium would be on insurance there, but you got to imagine where the cost of sending 27,000 kilograms into space was $1.5 billion. You have to assume that the insurance policy on that's pretty, pretty high. Mm.
So there was conversation around how much had been paid on insurance when one of Elon's rockets exploded.
Today's Falcon 9 rocket from SpaceX took that $1.5 billion for 27,000 pounds or 27,000 kilograms into space. That was $1.5 billion back in the day. Now Falcon 9, which is the reusable rocket, can do 22,000 kilograms for $62 million. So think about that decrease just be from reusing the rocket, right? So the rocket itself is where a lot of this money's going. So the insurance policy there, I hope you can find that stat because that would be incredible.
300 million insurance premiums on space shots in 2012 were 800 million.
Wow. I feel like the insurance business would be doing really well until the space elevator is developed, because then the risk and the cost goes down pretty drastically.
Guys, thank you for joining today on episode three. This was fun. Sean, welcome to the show. We were super happy that you could make it tonight. I want to put this up to a vote. I have my pick, but I want to put this up to a vote. Who gets the Space Cadet Award on this episode? We forgot it in episode two. I'm gonna vote, even though he disagreed with Elon Musk, I'm voting for Willie on this one. But I'm gonna give the group some voting power here. What do you guys think?
Pretty good. Didn't you say we had to do something to win it?
Yeah, that. Thank you, Nathan. I believe the
was
whoever came up with the best space elevator name would get the award. But
That's right. Good memory, Sean.
I guess that's not it. So
yes, guys, I'm gonna win. I'm gonna win this award right now. You ready for it? And this is how we're gonna sign off. I'm self-proclaiming myself the king with this. The Space Elevator, as per the Space Cadet podcast, will be called the Terrestrial Erection. Thanks for listening, guys, and good night.